This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Hello there, Joysters. This is Jim here. And you are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's a 1 minute past 10. And thank you to Leo and Brian for the Sound Museum. That keeps us up to date with our pop culture for the week, doesn't it? And they even talked about old-fashioned things like Richard Clapton and stuff tonight. So it's more than just latest pop culture. It's about culture when they talk about things like that.
That's why it's a museum, Jim.
That's why it's a museum, is it? Or it's a Wunderkammer.
I'm getting lots of thumbs up, so I hope that's a good thing. Maybe we're not loud enough.
No, I think that maybe means that they think that we listen to their show.
Excellent. Well, hopefully you're listening to our show too. We have an exciting show lined up for you this evening.
We did. There's been a double dissolution called.
There has been a double dissolution called. And luckily, we've got two journalists in the studio with us this evening.
And ones that know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I know. Not those crap ones. We don't like the crap ones.
No. We like the good ones. And that means the ones that we think are sensible. Anyway, you can join in the conversation too if you want to. You can SMS us on 0427 Joy 949. What's that Joy again? I never can remember it.
That is 0427 569 949, or you can email onair@joy.org.au, and we would love to hear from you.
And out on the front desk is Robert, and you can ring him on 1300 Joy 949 and berate him, and he'll run in here with a piece of paper and he'll stick it under our noses and tell us what to say.
He's now miming what it would look like if he was sticking the note up your nose, Jim.
Is he? Yeah. Oh, well, he's not going to be doing that.
Well, that might happen, but you just need to give us a call on 1300 on Joy 949. That's 1300 569.
Or email us onair@joy.org.au. And sitting next to me in the studio tonight, I've got Van Badham, who is an independent journalist, and she's properly credentialed these days, because she's a column in The Guardian for anybody that reads The Guardian. We like The Guardian.
We do.
And we read, that's the paper we read these days, that and the Saturday paper. Well, I didn't sponsor anybody.
But Saturday paper, if you're listening and would like to sponsor us, we'd love to hear from you.
Or Guardian, you could sponsor us too. And anyway, so hello, Van. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. It's been a very exciting
Welcome
few days.
To Joy.
I love it. It's joyous. I'm having a joyous time already.
We shall be able to talk about the exciting few days, plus a few other things in a minute, because really what we ask Van to come in to talk to us about tonight, and our other guest, who is Steph going to be?
Later in the show, we'll be talking to Lane Sainty from BuzzFeed. But it's mostly about new media, about the future of media in Australia, where we are, where
we're
going.
The Guardian and BuzzFeed on the one show.
Yeah.
Woohoo. Who
could do that? Coming together.
And we did invite them on to talk to us about the changes in the media landscape, because as you might know if you've been reading the paper and haven't got too bored with the idea that there might be an election, which is something that doesn't bore me at all. But anyway, is that the Minister for Communications, whose name is Mitch Fifield, who's a senator from Victoria, who took over for that portfolio from the Prime Minister, or as he's most fondly known in my house, the Prime Monster, the communications portfolio, he has managed to do what no communications minister has managed to do for years, and that is bring in so-called reforms to the media landscape, which I think means when you say reforms to the media landscape in Australia, it means you give Rupert Murdoch more power.
Boo.
And anyway, he's managed to bring those in. So we asked these professional and very good journalists to come and talk to us about something like that. But I think we might stray onto double dissolutions and things like that during tonight.
You never stray, Jim. No, you don't.
No,
you're
never
like
let it be
the
said.
Strayest of strays.
Am I? Watch out for the lots of dogs, home. I might end up there. Anyway, welcome, Van, again.
Hi.
What do you think about the dominance of Rupert Murdoch? Is that Is that what's going to happen under these new media laws?
Well, I'm not particularly thrilled about the dominance of Rupert Murdoch because we've seen such an erosion of the ABC and SBS, which are, of course, public broadcasters that are supposed to exist as a check on dominance of the media landscape by corporations or corporate individuals such as Mr. Murdoch. So I think that, you know, in Australia we've spent many years looking at our very tightly controlled media market and been quite critical of that. Obviously, digitisation has upended that playing field quite a lot, which is great. And you've seen new players enter the media market like The Guardian, like BuzzFeed, like Huffington Post, which is in Australia now, like The Daily Mail, which is online in Australia and absolutely huge.
But sometimes weird,
but that's okay. I mean, I love media diversity, which is the reason why I'm not so fond of everything being owned by Rupert Murdoch. But certainly we still consume a hell of a lot of TV and we also consume a lot of traditional media, and those media are not going away despite the disruption of digitisation.
I was surprised when my television went onto Channel 9 the other night. I was flicking and it actually works on Channel 9 because it doesn't ever get off the ABC or SBS usually.
So for people who, I guess, haven't really thought a lot about this, they, you know, have been getting the same paper for a while or they just read whatever is around, what is the downside to having one, or essentially one company or one person owning so many media outlets, both print and television and others?
Well, would you want all of your means of communication to be owned by one person and determined by their editorial control? I mean, the thing is that if you have a corporate media landscape with no players that have any kind of comparable ownership or buy-in.
But there is the Age and the Sydney Morning Herald too.
There's the Age and the Sydney Morning Herald and the Fairfax Group, who are in desperate trouble and announced this week that they were going to axe a quarter of their news staff,
and apparently
their editorial staff. They're going
to
lose a quarter.
I heard Greg Highfield, who's their CEO, say that was to save quality journalism.
Well, you know, I don't think that cutting a quarter of your editorial team is saving quality journalism. I think you want as many journalists employed to cover as much territory as possible. And of course, good journalism is expensive. It requires investment. It requires time. It requires resources. The effects of good journalism are things like, the impeachment of Richard Nixon, which I always look to as a journalist as being the ultimate sort of scalp, is that you can bring down a corrupt government with good journalism. And you can't bring down a corrupt government with bad journalism or no journalism.
To play devil's advocate, have we not seen, to use an example, a bad journalism bringing down politicians anyway? Like, for example, you know, the Murdoch press bringing down Julia Gillard without much journalism at all, seemingly.
Well, this is the thing. You know, we need a diverse media landscape. That's really important. And this is why we need to support those jobs remaining at Fairfax. And we also need to all support the retention of funding. In fact, the increase of funding at the ABC and at SBS, and certainly less political interference at those
and
broadcasters as well.
And who owns Sky News?
One of the large shareholders of Sky News is Rupert Murdoch.
Oh, and guess what Sky News announced tonight?
And what did they announce?
The Bolt report is coming back
five nights
Andy a week.
Bolt, who writes for the Herald Sun, which is a Murdoch newspaper.
And he used to have a show on Channel 10, which the chairperson of and CEO of which is Rupert Murdoch's eldest son, Lachlan.
Yeah. Well, see, this is the issue. You know, when you have a narrow media environment, you do get a narrow number of views because that's the point. You know, the way to make money out of a media environment is to control as much of it as possible.
But he must be hippie married Jerry Hall.
Jerry Hall. The big question is, do we really think the Rolling Stones made their best albums before Jerry Hall or after Jerry Hall? And I think that's the significant question for us all to answer
tonight.
Well,
she's not the Yoko Ono of the Rolling Stones, is she?
No, if only she could be the Yoko Ono of Rupert Murdoch, wouldn't that be wonderful? Can you imagine the bed-in of Jerry and Rupert announcing world peace?
No, I don't wish to imagine that.
So you mentioned about the degrading of ABC and SBS and interference. What are some of the ways that governments have been interfering with that independent media?
Well, obviously, the moment that you hold a big axe over everybody's head saying we're going to cut jobs, we're going to cut funding, we're going to cut resources, that means television shows will go, that means coverage will go, automatically you will foster a culture that is more cautious than it is courageous or experimental because, you know, as you, of course you would, because people have homes to pay for and children to look after, and the moment you threaten anybody's job, you do create like a more tense environment. We've seen direct political interference, like when Malcolm Turnbull demanded the head of Scott McIntyre, who was the SBS journalist who sent a couple of tweets querying the Anzac myth as being of value. Wherever you stand on that issue, whether you're pro-Anzac or anti-Anzac or Anzac critical, certainly I personally don't think that a sports broadcaster should have lost his job on the basis of his personal political beliefs about an over-revered national holiday. And certainly I think that is something that we should all be very concerned about, that, you know, the personal interference of, at that time, a minister was brought to bear on that situation. But also I think you have to look at the absolute furphy around Q&A last year, where Zaki Mallah, who was in the audience asking a question, expressing a point of view that needs to be heard whether you support him or not. And this is always the issue. Like, democracy is not about what you like, it's about what you need to know in order to make comprehensive decisions about everybody. And the silencing of opinions that are difficult or uncomfortable or unpleasant is really dangerous. And to use that as a pretext to clamp down on current affairs programming, to instigate a review into the ABC and this ongoing obsession of the governments with left-wing bias in the ABC, when study after study comes out that actually the ABC tends to defer slightly to the right rather than the left, is a real concern. I mean, it looks like political witch hunting. Far be it from me to suggest that it would. But certainly I know that writing for The Guardian, because it's independently owned, like we're owned by the Scott Trust, we're not a corporation. We were founded by an incredible investment of democratic citizens of the United Kingdom who wanted there to always be an independent newspaper a very long time ago, and we still continue with that model of employment. It means that I have a lot more freedom than if I was working for a public broadcaster to say the things that I believe and to back my opinion in that way. And I think that's a concern, that if we start scapegoating people for not having the right political beliefs in the right place at the right political climate, well, obviously you're setting up a system of political relations which are potentially compromising.
I have a particular bugbear about the ABC myself, and that is that I think that they've undermined the quality of journalism in this country, because they're doing what we're doing tonight. They do what we do, what we're doing tonight, and that's interview journalists. And so, you know, when I worked in politics, Barry Cassidy was the media advisor to the Prime Minister, and now he's on every Sunday morning on The Insiders talking to a whole stack of journalists, lots of whom are from good old Murdoch papers and things like that, just reinforcing views, in my opinion. And I'm not sure that it's actually the correct way, the best way to get a diversity of media views. And I also don't like the way the ABC has gone into the business of celebritising its quite good journalists, and I think trivialising them. So I think Annabelle Crabb and Lee Sales, for instance, are being trivialised at the moment by all those pop culture shows that they're doing on.
Well, certainly I think there's a place, and like a well-resourced national broadcaster allows you to look at news and current events in all kinds of different formulations. And speaking specifically about the Mitch Fifield reforms, whenever there's a Conservative government, the word reform takes on a chilling tone. As far as I'm concerned, I can say that. Certainly part of the issue with the Fifield reforms, and there's been a lot of pushback from the National Party, is that the reforms will mean that there's less regional specific broadcasting and regional specific media because of the change in reach. At the moment, it's been the case for a long time that a broadcaster can only broadcast to 75% of the population at any given time, and there have been rules around Australian content which have been watered down enormously, like over the past few decades. But it means that we're really losing a specification around regional areas and regional communities, which is potentially really dangerous. If you look at where closures have happened and where ABC cuts fell last year, in particular, ABC broadcasting in regional areas took some heavy cuts. And looking at the Fairfax problems as well, that Fairfax's business model has not been able to support some of its regional publications. Mm. We're looking at a really quite vulnerable part of the Australian community, which is regionally based Australians and rural based Australians, people living in isolated areas who, you know, are falling out of a public political discourse that should represent them. And I think that's a real concern. I mean, for us living in the city, our awareness of what goes on in regional areas is pretty compromised by our own geography and our immersion in our metropolitan.
But if you're living in Perth or Adelaide or Brisbane, you're getting a very, very southeast capital city representation of the news as well.
Absolutely. And these are real concerns. I mean, what should our media look like? Should it look like some of us? Should it look like those of us who have a privileged kind of access to centres of population and centres of power where the infrastructure of power is located? Or should it look like all of us?
Well, there's a few more things for us to talk about, which we will do after these messages.
We're going to some messages. We'd love to hear from you, 0427JOY949 or email onair@joy.org.au.
Is nothing sacred on Joy 94.9.
Indeed.
Joy 94.9 has a huge range of programs available for podcast. In fact, Joy is one of the largest podcasting communities on community radio. If you haven't checked out our podcasting service, you're missing out. Visit joy.org.au, click on the podcast tab, and you'll find a list of Joy programs regularly sharing the best interviews, news, and reviews. There's tens of thousands of hours for you to enjoy, so check it out now. joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. It's Jim here. And I'm here with Steph and Van Badham from The Guardian, and we're talking things media and elections tonight. And that was The Wonderful Prince with Purple Rain. It was the short version. I could have inflicted upon you.
I love him. I love Prince so much. Oh, God.
I could have inflicted the 14-minute
version. I love him.
But I don't think I'd have been allowed to.
Yes. Yes, you would.
So one day we can. Next week. Next week it's Easter. When it's a holiday, we tend to get a bit cruisier.
That's true.
And play 14-minute songs.
But we might play more Prince next week if everybody likes that idea.
Yes, well, Prince week. Oh.
If you are pro or con that plan, please SMS us on 0427JOY949. That's 0427 569 949. Or you can email us. The address is onair, one word, at joy.org.au. So, Jim, you've been dying to ask about this double dissolution. So, you know, you've lasted 23 minutes.
I know. It's good, isn't it? I've been very good. Van, tell us. Am I going to preempt your column tomorrow?
No.
Is the double dissolution going to save us?
Save us from what? Save us from Turnbull? I don't know. I mean, the polls are improving for Labor. It looks as though that Bill Shorten has worked out that actually having policy makes a huge advantage when you're competing with Malcolm Turnbull, who has none apart from cut corporate tax rates. That's literally all the Liberal Party are running on at the moment. Well, we're going to cut the corporate tax rate.
For small business.
We don't really know what we're doing, but we think we might cut the corporate tax rate, you know, on the day that the head of the Australian ASX is in some kind of interesting trouble. They're saying that they want to, you know, the ABC see legislation back in to deal with a non-existent problem.
I always ask everybody that goes on to me about the ABCC, the Australian Building and Construction Commission, which is meant to deal with corruption in the CMFEU. I always say, well, why don't we let the courts deal with the so-called corruption in the CMFEU?
Why don't we and actually why don't prosecute we get the, why don't people we get, if there are crimes committed?
Well, there are apparently 100 court cases at the moment, but they haven't been completed yet, so we don't know whether there's been corruption or not.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, the ABCC is not about corruption. The ABCC is about creating an extraordinary mechanism to suppress one union in particular, and that union is the CFMEU. Why? Because it's a very highly organised, member-focused, efficient and effective, you know, worker representative organisation. And the ABCC is, it keeps people alive on the job. A lot of people don't understand that construction is very dangerous. Like, the buildings don't appear without risk. And usually development in Australia is, you know, based around some very tight margins of time, meaning that the temptation is always to get the building up as soon as possible. And that can be a very risky process. Not to mention, there have been rather a lot of historical cases of unscrupulous development. I can tell you this, I'm from Wollongong, and certainly if you're looking at an infrastructure that has had an unscrupulous tenant, well, certainly bringing governmental pressure to bear on those pesky unions who demand things like occupational health and safety and safety inspections and union visits on site, well, putting the screws on them may lead to more accidents, but you might be able to complete your projects faster. And I think we have to be very honest about, you know, what the actual focus of that legislation is, and it's to make life a little bit more comfortable for developers.
Who must be on the other side of it. And this is a big if there is union corruption, then there must be another side to that, and the other side to that has to be corporate corruption.
Well, surely. Of course. I mean, and what the position of the ACTU has been, which is the position I support, is, well, why don't we have a federal independent commission against corruption? Like, if we're concerned about corruption, corruption doesn't just affect the construction industry.
I noticed
it affects finance.
That is the position of Senator Glenn Lazarus.
Yes, Lazarus.
Independent Queensland, former party, Palmer United Party.
Yeah, Lazarus has been very strong on this. So has Xenia Wang. He's been, you know, he's usually pretty quiet, Senator, but this is his big thing. Ricky Muir has said the same thing. Oh, so have we brought in Senate voting changes in order to
get rid of those three?
Yeah, to get rid of those pesky crossbenchers who, you know, do not come from the professional political class, who do have experiences beyond that of the majority of people in Parliament in terms of diversity as a group. And certainly what's been brought to bear on them is their political annihilation, manipulated very effectively, you know, combining the electoral vanity of the Greens and, oh, we've had this position since 2004 and we're just going to stick with it. No matter what Malcolm Turnbull wants to do, we're going to get our policy realised, and it's going to be more democratic. It's going to lead to a wipeout of the crossbench, a disabling of one of the few democratic mechanisms we have to get independents into the Senate. It's going to get really, really hard for those people to get elected. The disenfranchisement of around 3 million Australians, and it plays, of course, into the hands of Malcolm Turnbull to turn around to the crossbenchers and go, you're going to get wiped out. The Senate voting change has gone through. I would like this legislation, or there's going to be a double dissolution, which will make your life even harder.
But, you know, it isn't beyond the imagination to think that there could be the sort of development in the Australian political scene where that some of those small micro parties might actually do the sort of Bernie Sanders and collect a lot of money. Now, the Americans have turned around quite a lot of their political donation system by micro donations. For both Obama when he was first running and now Bernie Sanders?
Well, I mean, they're very,
what
very
happened,
different systems.
What happened if that happened?
Well,
and people,
I mean,
funded those people?
Well, I mean, yes, there's a pool of funding out there, but we've already been microfunding in Australia and crowdsourcing funding of political parties for years. I mean, I'm independent. I get the newsletters from all the political parties asking me for money all the time. They're quite, anybody who thinks that, you know, Adam Band or the Labor Party or the Liberals aren't constantly crowdfunding is optimistic about their electoral fortunes. Obviously, some political parties attract larger donations from the big end of town than others do. But certainly my concern, and one of the reasons why I was on a practical level opposed to the Senate voting changes, and I'm very opposed to them, I think they're anti-democratic, is certainly in Australia one of the things we have avoided to this point is a united and cohesive far-right movement. our little far-right parties have been pretty separate to this point. You know, they have their little factional battles between Reclaim Australia and the UPF and the XFF or the QFF or whatever they're called. But certainly now that the old Senate preferencing system is out the window with the lots of micro-parties each, you know, able to pursue their own sort of electoral tactic, there's quite an impetus there for them to all unite and form a single unified far-right party to try and collect some of those votes that exist in the, you know, between 20 and 25% of Australians who vote for micro parties. And certainly if they do unite, that's probably a Senate quota in a regular election amongst that pool that's maybe available with the changes. And I think that's something to be very concerned about. But certainly, I mean, I'm really disappointed that the changes went through. I think it was either disingenuous or naive from Richard Di Natale to think that once those changes went through, Turnbull wouldn't turn around and go, well, hey, everybody, let's have a double dissolution and I can completely annihilate you. And certainly today, the kind of backtracking that's been going on, you know, the hugs after that great big Senate sleepover the other night where they were so proud of what they'd achieved with this reform that's really going to, like I said, disable one of the few mechanisms that we have to get that kind of diversity represented in a really important area of our parliament. The Senate's supposed to be a house of review. It's not supposed to be a forum for a rubber stamp. And certainly, you know, the Liberals are highly sophisticated political players. They've been in this for a very long time. And I think that they've worked this situation to their electoral advantage, and I think that was obvious to anybody. It's about ramming through an agenda that has to do with dismantling trade unionism in Australia. That's what, they've always been quite open about that. You know, they pursued the Trade Union Royal Commission to try and smear every, you know, union leader and union organisation in this country and damage the brand of unionism. And now they're going after the most overwhelming, you know, legislative means possible in order to do that. And I think we have to be honest that that's what's been going on.
We do need to finish up very shortly, but we do have a message from Damien. And Damien says, if 3 million voters want to vote for micro-parties next election, there's nothing stopping them from voting for them again under the new Senate reforms.
Apart from the fact that there's a provision in the changes that you can just vote one at the top of the paper the way you always have, and you might think that your vote's being distributed, except it will exhaust. And I don't know how we're going to get that message very clearly explained to the entire voting electorate. So actually, a lot of people who think their vote will count, their vote will not count.
It will only count if they go under the line and number every box.
Yeah, and that's apparently going to be legal for this election, but it's now 1 to 12 under the line. The new system is designed to exhaust votes, which means that you, where you might have put number one for the Animals Who Wear Hats party, thinking, oh, well, they'll distribute my vote onwards.
They've got
to
the best
friends.
Videos on YouTube.
I love the Animals Who Wear Hats party. I'm very loyal. I have a party card in my wallet. But in the way that you would think that they would make that decision for you, and ultimately the aims of that party would be reflected somewhere, which is, of course, how Ricky Muir got elected. I mean, he was preferenced by 23 political parties. I mean, it wasn't that he just got given a free bag of lollies and got to be a senator. Like, rather a lot of people across quite a spectrum of belief, you know, directed preferences towards him because they thought he was all right. And that gets forgotten a lot in this conversation. It's kind of the establishment of the professional political class and the old mechanisms out the window.
We do need to wrap up. We're running a little bit over time, but thank you so much for chatting with us. It was definitely a lot of food for thought. And we'd love to have you back again.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love Joy. I've got to say, this radio station has the best interior decorating of Woo-hoo! Any of the radio stations in Melbourne.
Thank you so much. You're listening.
The drapes are hung nicely.
It's the lanterns, everybody. It's the paper lanterns.
You're listening to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. We've been talking media diversity and elections and things Australian politics, federal politics. Tonight with Van Badham, who's a columnist for The Guardian. And Van has now had to rush off home. She's got deadlines for The Guardian. So hopefully she's going home to, so we can read her column tomorrow in that. But we do have on the phone now another very well-known young independent journalist, I believe from BuzzFeed this time. Is that right, Steph?
Yes. Are you there, Lane?
I am. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for speaking with us. So we're speaking.
Thanks for having me.
With Lane Santee from BuzzFeed. Now, I was really keen to talk to you because I guess BuzzFeed is one of the media outlets that is often used as an example of new media when people are moving away from the old institutions, you know, like maybe reading The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald. I guess, what has this shift been and what does this mean in terms of the kinds of news that people are getting and the kinds of things that people are reading now?
So I guess working at BuzzFeed is really interesting because, yeah, as you say, it is often really held up as a company that's at the forefront of new media and shifts away from kind of traditional notions of news and news gathering as we know it. So I guess I think a lot of the time we see stories on BuzzFeed that go well and on other sites that are, you know, digital native sites that really started and grew up on the internet. It's the same kind of stories that people like to read in traditional media. People like to read human interest stories. They like to read things that make them feel things, particularly on the internet. We find that stories that do tend to go well, the kind of stories that really invoke a lot of emotion in people, they can relate to the people they're seeing in them. And things like that. So I think, you know, the shift is obviously huge in a lot of ways, you know, in terms of what you're reading, the format you're reading it in, the business models used by these companies. But I think the fundamentals that people just like to read good stories online about people they can relate to and issues that, you know, make them feel things, I think that has remained quite constant.
So I guess as a journalist, but also as a young person yourself, what would be some of the responses, your response to when people say things like journalism is in decline, young people have short attention spans, young people are apathetic, like these kinds of cliches? Do you think, as someone who talks to lots of young people as well, does this hold true or not really?
I don't think it holds true at all, to be honest. I think there's a lot of cynicism about the direction of the media industry, and I think, you know, a lot of that is because now that so many organisations exist purely online, or at least a large amount of their audience is coming online, that the limited space of online and the kind of 24-hour nature of the news cycle has led to a lot more content being churned out than there was before. And, you know, people obviously look at that sometimes and think, oh, this is just crap. Which I think is probably a pretty simplistic way to look at it. You know, there's a lot of really interesting stuff out there online and there's a lot of engagement with it. And that's one of the really interesting things about online media, is that level of engagement that you can immediately get. You put something out there and it's, you know, it's not a case of like in, you know, historically in the media, you know, it comes out in the paper and then, you know, the next day there might be a few letters about it. You put it out online and it's immediately there and there's immediately feedback. And we actually find that there's a huge amount of interaction on posts on BuzzFeed. And, you know, it's not just young people who are interacting with, that young people are just interacting with posts that people might think are really typical of BuzzFeed, like cat lists and quizzes and things like that. We find a lot of young people really engaged with our political content, particularly because we spend a lot of time working on Twitter and on Facebook and kind of paying attention to the way that we present the stories that we do on social media. So that is, I guess, just a big way to connect with those young audiences. But, yeah, we absolutely found that there's a lot of interest for political news, you know, non-political news and that kind of traditional news, as well as the quizzes and lists that BuzzFeed is so famous for.
Lane, it's Jim here, and I'm one of those old things that does admit to reading BuzzFeed and started reading BuzzFeed because of the Cats in Hats and things,
yeah.
I've got to say. But I actually think, fair. I mean, I understand what you're saying and I sort of agree with you in a lot of ways, but I do think that there's an added responsibility for journalism professionals if they're going to engage via the online media in the way that BuzzFeed does and other people do through online media and through Twitter and so on. And, you know, I use those things myself, but I do think there's a level of responsibility in the 24-hour news cycle that perhaps hasn't been quite so evident for journalists in the past, to make sure that what they're writing is accurate and responsible, and that, you know, we've seen some examples of journalism in the past few weeks over the "Let's get the gays and lesbians out of the schools" campaign, mm-hmm. which has been a really, really irresponsible journalism and is probably harming kids.
But that's being perpetrated by traditional media
outlets. It has been, not only traditional media, but also it's part of the news cycle. It's part of the 24-hour news cycle, and it's been popping up everywhere. You know, so people like BuzzFeed and the HuffPost, which are probably the two most obvious big 24-hour news cycle groups here. But even mm-hmm. we've just been talking to Van Badham from The Guardian before we were talking to you, and even things like The Guardian, I think, need, you know, I look at all you guys as having an added responsibility for good journalism, and I just want to know whether it's actually sustainable, in your opinion, good journalism.
Whether journalism online is sustainable.
Yeah, whether you're just going to be sucked into the cycle.
Do you mean that whether it's sustainable in terms of the speed of news getting faster and faster?
Yeah, speed of news getting faster and faster, so therefore there's a greater responsibility, and is that sustainable? Or do you just burn out because you have to follow whatever the most prolific tweeter, or the maddest person? Or the worst thing that's on the front page of the Murdoch press?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think the answer to it is probably a lot more complex than I'm able to give right now. But I guess my initial thoughts are that I think that's a concern for all journalists working in the industry these days, whether they are at a company like BuzzFeed or at, you know, a traditional masthead like The Australian, where the attacks on the Safe Schools Coalition that you referenced originated. And I think that, you know, we are seeing across the board that journalists are struggling in a lot of ways to keep up with the demands of the 24-hour news cycle, both in terms of speed and in terms of accuracy. I guess, like, I can...
Is it easier to fall in line with the dominant view?
The dominant view of whatever's in the news cycle at that moment?
Do you ever get that temptation to go, oh, just repeat that?
Not really. I guess I cover a very specific beat, being LGBTI issues in Australia.
I better follow you.
You know, it's something,
should follow her on Twitter. Yeah.
It's something that a lot of, you know, obviously a lot of traditional media organisations have been covering LGBTI issues for years, but I guess it's only quite recently that we've seen major organisations really devote reporters and time to playing out those issues. And so I find a lot of the time that I'm trying to look for, you know, stories around what's happening in the traditional mastheads and speaking to people. I speak to a lot of young people in my work, partly because that's our audience and partly because I also find that young people aren't the voices that are being really heard in the LGBTI community. So I don't find myself a lot kind of looking at what other people are doing or saying. And I think particularly with the, you know, the rhetoric in the media around the Safe Schools Coalition, even the, you know, the reporting of it that hasn't been quite inherently steeped in homophobia, as I think it's quite fair to say most of the coverage in The Australian has been.
Yeah.
There's still been a fair amount of, I guess I feel like there's been a fair amount of taking the things that various politicians are saying at face value and, you know, repeating some of the claims uncritically. And, you know, that's something that I've been really, really determined to not do over the past month, just because I think, you know, this program has obviously been willfully misrepresented, and it's so important to reverse those kinds of things. So I guess, in answer to your question, no, I don't really find myself doing that a lot.
This is quite a personal question, so feel free to not answer. But I'm wondering, has this taken a toll on you, this, I guess, constantly trying to, using this as an example, to speak the truth while others don't?
I think, you know, it would be... I'd definitely be lying if I said that covering LGBTI issues is always easy as an LGBTI person, and listening to some of the stuff that is said. I guess a lot of the time I try to just channel that into my work and think about how I, you know, if I'm feeling those things as like a very comfortably out person in my 20s and, you know, with a partner and who's been out for years, then, you know, there must be so many other people in the community who are not as out or as comfortable as I am. And, you know, so I really try and channel those feelings into just kind of being really grateful for the platform that I do have and trying to use that to make sure those other voices are getting in there and making sure that my coverage is, I guess, as representative of those voices that might not get a chance.
Mm. We do have a message from a listener, from Damien. He said, I don't think anything has changed in terms of quality versus average journalism in new media. There's still terrific content as well as dross. Is that a typo? Gross?
Or no, dross? I think it's dross, because I think he means the cats in hats. That is dross.
Right.
I back that. I think that's a good take.
But, you know, I think to go on with that thread, I think the best thing that's been said on Safe Schools has been said by a straight person this week, and that was Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews, who said that he thought that the Liberal politicians, the neoconservative politicians who were opposed to it, were just opposed to the idea that there might be gay and lesbian kids.
Mm.
And they didn't like to think about that, so that's why they were really opposed to it. And I think that needed to be a lot more prominent in the news cycle than it was, and it wasn't very prominent anywhere at all, which I was quite disappointed with.
Well, I mean, I guess... Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm jumping in before you have a chance to answer. I guess following on Twitter, that is something that was said a lot on Twitter. And so I guess, yeah, then my next question would be, what's the role of social media as compared to... I guess, news media, and is it that, yeah, well, I guess that's the end of the question. What's the different roles that they play and how do they relate to each other?
Social media is just a platform, surely.
I use social media in a lot of different ways. I guess I spend a lot of my time on Twitter because that is where I actually find a lot of sources. A lot of people in the LGBTI community are on Twitter, particularly a lot of young people. And it's a place where I find I can really, you know, gauge opinions, find people, or, you know, just find someone who knows someone. It's a really good way of making those connections. I think it's also, in a lot of ways, a good way of figuring out what kind of issues people want to hear about. If, you know, you tweet something or someone else has tweeted something and it starts moving, you know, picking up a lot of retweets or favourites in a short period of time, it's normally a pretty good barometer that issue is something people actually want to hear more about beyond social media. And some, you know, it's a way of kind of gauging what stories are worth following and what are not. Because, you know, in BuzzFeed in Australia, our news team is very small. There's only six of us doing news in Australia. So, you know, we pick our stories pretty carefully. We, you know, there's a lot of experimentation in there, but social media is one way that we can really gauge whether or not a story is worth picking up because, yeah, our resources are not there to cover, you know, the majority of stuff that's happening in Australia and that large organisations would be covering every day.
So that's quite a big commitment from BuzzFeed then, if they have six staff and one specialist in LGBTI young people. That's something to be proud of, I guess
it is quite cool. I guess I think I kind of fell into the role a little, I guess, accidentally. Like, I applied for a job, the political reporter job, which I was, a bit underqualified for, and just kind of applied to get an interview, maybe some practice. I really didn't think anything would come of it, and then ended up getting really lucky and not getting that job. But they said, do you want to come on as like a more junior reporter and focus on LGBTI issues, because that's obviously your area of interest. So that's kind of how it happened. But we do, one of the other six reporters, my colleague Alan, he focuses on Indigenous affairs in Australia. Then we've got two politics reporters, a news editor and a social news reporter who does kind of online news, things that are moving online, memes, trends, stuff like that. So we do find that looking at issues from communities that, have historically and presently been marginalised is a way that BuzzFeed can really make inroads, because a lot of those communities do exist online and have been empowered by being online in a lot of ways. So, yeah.
Mm. We are nearly out of time, but I've got one more question. What do you think the future holds for Australian media? Where do you think we are heading next in terms of the platform and the format, and as well as content?
I think that the next move, this isn't Australia specific, but I guess just the Western media, which is what I'm familiar with, is a move away from the kind of homepage model that we've all become accustomed to online, and looking more to social media and news and content being distributed just via social media. So things like Facebook, instant articles, video content online, and Snapchat and Instagram, all of those kinds of things are increasingly where young people consume their news. In a lot of instances, it's where young people exclusively consume their news and media, and I think looking to platforms is and social media platforms is definitely the direction it's heading in.
Great, thank you so much for talking with us. That's given me a lot to think about.
I just found you and followed you.
There you go.
Okay,
you'll have
great.
A new Twitter follower. Thank you so much. We'd love to have you on again as our Sydney LGBTI reporter for Joy 94.9.
Yeah.
So,
great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
We're going to have to finish up, Jim. I think it's time for us to say goodnight.
That went fast, didn't it?
It was pretty fast.
Good guests.
Good guests. So,
two
yes.
great young women journalists on tonight, Van Badham from The Guardian, and I'm sure she won't mind me saying that she's an opinionated one, that one. And I like the opinions. And Lane Sainty from BuzzFeed, who was also opinionated. And had some really good points to make about all those new media platforms. I can't even understand some of them. Snapchat, I just do not understand
how it works.
I don't understand why it works. Doesn't it disappear? Something and it disappears after however many seconds?
Not many seconds, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, how do you get news out of that?
We shall see. But the time has come for us to say goodnight. Next up, we have a little pot of joy. Thanks for listening. And thank you for Damien for texting in. It's good. I don't think we've had text from Damien before. So thank you very much for that. It's great to meet you, Damien. You have been listening to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. Next up, a little pot of joy. So good night.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.